Right, we'll have the marshal call the first case. Go ahead.
The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Frisch, Judge Johnson, Judge Cleary, the Honorable Jennifer F. Frisch presiding.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is October 1st, believe it or not, 2020. We have three cases for oral argument on our calendar this morning. We're here on our first matter, LeClaire versus Commissioner of Public Safety, file A20-0455. Again, please mute your microphones if you are not speaking. Each party will have 15 minutes for oral argument, and the appellant will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. The marshal is showing your running clock of time. Please keep an eye on your time. I'd ask that you identify yourself before you begin speaking on behalf of your client. And with that, I'll have the marshal set the clock, and counsel, you may proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Adam Kajawa, and I represent the appellant in this matter, Scott LeClaire. This is an appeal from a decision sustaining the revocation of appellant's driving privileges under Minnesota's implied consent law. This case comes down to whether or not the officer blocked appellant's vehicle when he parked behind it. Question, and you parked your vehicle in front of Mr. LeClaire's driveway, correct? Answer, correct. So if Mr. LeClaire wanted to back out of his driveway, he would not have been able to do so because your car would have been blocking it. Answer, yeah, I would agree with that statement. Question, so you blocked Mr. LeClaire's driveway? Answer, that is where I stopped. Yes. Your honors, this case comes down to whether or not the Fourth Amendment rights were violated when the officer seized Mr. LeClaire without justification. Specifically, the appellant is arguing that the car was seized when the officer blocked his driveway, preventing his vehicle from leaving. The district court erred when it determined that no seizure took place. Today, I'm asking this court to correct two errors made by the district court. First, it was clearly erroneous when the court determined that the record was unclear whether the officer blocked appellant's vehicle or not. Second, the district court misapplied the law when it determined that no seizure took place because the officer did not intentionally or purposefully block appellant's vehicle. First, I will discuss the facts of this case. Then I will move to the district court's clearly erroneous factual finding before moving on to the misapplication of the law regarding the seizure.
Mr. Kajawa, am I correct in understanding? I think you've raised additional issues in your brief besides the two that you just identified, correct?
Your Honor, there are additional issues. Essentially, when I say that I'm going to the misapplication of law regarding seizure, in my brief, I argue that there was, if this court determines that the seizure did not take place when the officer parked blocking the vehicle, then the court must find that a seizure took place when the car door was opened, and that both seizures weren't based on reasonable articulable suspicion.
So that, I mean, that issue that's in your brief with respect to opening the car door, you're not abandoning that argument. You're simply focusing your oral argument on other issues. Is that
Mike, that's correct, Your Honor. I think that the main issue in this case is the blocking. If this court determines that the blocking was not a seizure, then certainly a seizure happened when the door opened. And I will address that certainly if that's questions that the court has, I will address that in length.
I don't think you probably don't need to tell any of us about the facts of the case. Our court is generally very well prepared with and has a thorough understanding of the facts, but I have a question about one of the legal issues. So under EDJ, which is the Supreme Court's seminal case about seizures, the general test is that whether given all the circumstances, a reasonable person would believe that he or she was not free to go, right? You understand, you're familiar with that test. But in this situation, I mean, isn't it fair to say that one of the circumstances is that your client was asleep or he was not conscious, and that in that circumstance, a reasonable person who was asleep or unconscious would have no perception about whether or not he was free to leave. It seems that it's difficult. If the issue of seizure depends upon the perceptions of the person who was allegedly seized, I'm not sure how we can get to a finding of seizure if that person had no perceptions whatsoever.
Your Honor, because Minnesota follows the objective reasonable person standard. That objective reasonable person standard has to do with a reasonable person in the defendant's circumstances, not the state of mind that the particular defendant was in.
If I can stop you there, but don't those circumstances that you just mentioned, don't that those circumstances include the fact that he was asleep or unconscious?
The state argues that, and the state uses the Leverson case, I believe, to argue that. It's an unpublished case, but they argue that because the appellant was unconscious, a seizure could not have possibly occurred. In Leverson, this court dismissed that very argument. This court said that that argument is not supported by case law because Minnesota follows the objective reasonable person standard. Following that standard, this court in the unpublished Leverson case said, in the final analysis, despite respondents' arguments to the contrary, appellant's subjective state of mind is simply irrelevant to our disposition on this issue.
Are you aware of any published case law on this issue? And I'm even outside of Minnesota, I guess I'm wondering. I understand there probably is not case law in Minnesota, but I'm wondering about other jurisdictions that apply the Fourth Amendment.
Well, certainly, Your Honor, this case in the U.S. Supreme Court in the Mendenhall case adopt that objective reasonable person standard. That was a 1980 United States Supreme Court case where they said we must look to the reasonable person standard. They didn't directly address the state of mind, but certainly that is what we must look to, the objective reasonable person standard. Further, this court in State v. DeMars, the state argued the same thing. It is an unpublished case, but this court decided that. And although it is not binding on this court, it should certainly be persuasive because this court has consistently held that. In DeMars, the state argued the same thing the state is arguing here, that because respondent was unconscious or asleep, he could not have felt seized. That was their argument. This court concluded, quote, the test is whether a reasonable person would consider himself seized in the circumstances. And the constitutional requirement do not vary with the subjective state of mind of the individual. Those are two unpublished cases, the Leverson case and the DeMars case. Both of them, and though both of those cases, the state specifically argued that because the driver was unconscious, he could have not felt seized. Both times, this court in both of those cases concluded that it was the subjective state of mind, the objective state of mind of a reasonable person and not the state of mind of the defendant at the time. In both of those cases, this court made that conclusion. This court cannot make a different conclusion in these cases where the issues raised by the state are identical. The arguments raised by the state are identical. As far as your question regarding, do I know of any published cases outside of the state of Minnesota? Unfortunately, Your Honor, I don't have any published cases specifically to a passed out driver, but I think certainly the Leverson and DeMars cases consistent, if this court is going to rule consistent with past rulings on the same issue, those cases are very, very much on point.
Another part of the seizure test from EDJ is has to do more with the conduct of the officer or the facts that could be perceived by the person, such as, and EDJ says, a seizure is more likely if there are several officers, if there's a weapon, if there's a physical touching, if there's language or tone of voice that demands compliance. Now you focused a lot on the physical location of the vehicle. I mean, I'm wondering how we analyze that. Do we analyze the, do we consider the physical location of the vehicle at the end of the driveway along with those other factors that I mentioned, or is the blocking essentially by itself sufficient? Is it like a single factor factor that overcomes all of the, that makes up those other factors irrelevant?
Thank you, Your Honor. My answer to that is two parts. First, yes, my argument is that single factor alone, this court and the federal courts have consistently held that blocking is enough. And I can go into that case law. But in this case, we not only have the blocking, we have other shows of force. And those shows of force are as follows. The circumstances, all the circumstances surrounding this are this, that instead of parking next to the curb along the street, the officer parked with his car parallel to the road across the driveway, perpendicular to appellant's vehicle. He turned on his rear-facing squad car lights and shined his spotlight onto the car. I think it's important to note this, that this court has distinguished between rear-facing and forward-facing lights before. That is a correct distinction. If an officer pulls up behind a defendant, they look in their rearview mirror, they can't see any lights facing forward. Those rear-facing lights, they can't see because they're traffic lights to the other vehicle. In this case, the way the officer parked perpendicular to my client, had my client looked in his rearview mirror, he would have looked and saw flashing lights behind him coming from a squad car with the spotlight shining in. You can't tell when you're perpendicular whether those lights are flashing forwards or backwards. So I think that's important. So we have here the officer blocking him with his lights on, with his spotlight on. In addition, that officer testified that he parked where he did to show authority. His testimony was that he parked there so that the homeowner could see that it was apparent that he was a police officer. Showing and parking there for a reason to show he's a police officer is further showing his authority through his squad car, lights on, blocking the appellant. All of those circumstances must be considered. But I think that the most important circumstance to consider is the blocking, because Minnesota courts have consistently held that if a vehicle is blocked, it is considered a seizure. In the Colts case, Minnesota Court of Appeals, this court said, if police engage in some other action which one would not expect between two private citizens, such as boxing in a car, it is likely event, we consider that a Fourth Amendment seizure. In the Sanger case, this court again said in the facts of that case where the officer pulled up beside the car and behind the car, there was another car in front. So the officer essentially boxed in the car with his car and another car. This court again concluded that the blocking of the vehicle alone constituted the seizure. There was no lights in that case, just the blocking alone.
Also, you don't have a whole lot of time left. Were you going to address the approaching of the car and the curtilage and the opening of the door?
Certainly, I will address that. Thank you, Your Honor. If this court finds that the seizure did not take place at the moment the car parked there, then this court must find that a seizure took place at the moment he opened the door. The officer said he was walking to the front door of the home. His attention was diverted. He was not walking on the path then. He diverted from the sidewalk and began walking towards the vehicle. As he was walking towards the vehicle, the officer testified that he shined his light inside of that vehicle because he wanted to see if there was keys in it. The reason for that shine was to find evidence of a crime. Now, this court has said in the past that shining a light into a vehicle generally is not considered a seizure, except if that officer did so from a vantage point, if the officer unlawfully acquired their position vis-a-vis the vehicle unlawfully. Here we have an officer entering the curtilage, a protected area, shines his light in the vehicle. He sees that a pound is there. He sees that he's sleeping. He sees that he is breathing. And then he goes, without trying to wake up the defendant, opens the door immediately. That's a show of force that we cannot deny. In the Lopez case, this court, the Supreme Court found that blocking the vehicle and opening the door was a seizure. At that point, there was no reasonable articulable suspicion for Mr. LeClaire, because all the officer knew is that Mr. LeClaire was asleep in his vehicle. There could be several innocent explanations for being asleep in his vehicle. That is not reasonable articulable suspicion for a crime, is not a justification for a seizure. In this case, there is clearly a seizure without justification. Therefore, I ask that this court reverse the district court's finding.
Thank you, counsel. Anything else from the panel this morning? All right, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Counsel, you may proceed. Your mute button.
May it please the court, counsel, I think the, my name is Leah Hedman. I'm an assistant attorney general, and I'm here on behalf of respondent in this matter. There's two issues brought by appellant that he wanted to focus on, and I'll address those and the court's questions to begin my presentation. The first thing is that he said there is clearly erroneous whether the court's finding in trial court, whether the officer blocked in the car in the record, whether that was clear. And there is, that's found in finding of fact number 5, and there is support in the record for that. Why it was clearly, why it was unclear is on page 9 of the transcript, where it says, I think it might have been a, I don't recall exactly where I was parked. Do you know if you blocked the driveway? It's possible. I don't recall exactly where I was parked. I think it might have been a few, because I think there was another vehicle parked just to the left of that car. So I think there may have been some space at the end of the driveway.
But he also testified that if the driver wanted to leave, he would not be able to leave because of the positioning of his squad car.
Right. And so I think we should take into account, this is a Mitsubishi Eclipse, one of the very smallest sports cars on the market. And if he says there is space at the end of the driveway, the court's finding here, the trial court, is not clearly erroneous, because that's true. It was not clear. And the record is not clear. This officer said two different things at two different positions in the thing. Yes, if he were to back out, he would hit my squad car. But was there still space at the end? And if the driveway is two cars wide, what he's telling you, if there's still space, then there could have been space to come through. The record is
unclear. But he said there wasn't space to come through. But he said there wasn't space to come through because he couldn't.
Yeah, let's go back to Judge, Your Honor. So this is on page 9, and he says, because I think there was another vehicle parked just to the left of that car, so I think there may have been some space at the end of the driveway. But so he does indicate, and the trial court was not clearly erroneous when she found that it wasn't really clear whether he was fully blocked in.
Counsel, wait a second. Now, he contradicted himself a few minutes later in cross-examination and suggested that if Mr. Clare wanted to back out of the driveway, he would not have been able to because the car was blocking it. Yes, I agree with that statement. That's what he said.
Yes, I fear. So, you know, again, sometimes the testimony comes in different forms, and this was an officer on cross-examinations. But that is only furthering the fact that the district court didn't err when they said it wasn't clear, because you're right. Exactly. He said both things. There was space, or, you know, but if he would have backed out straight, he might not have been able to get past me. So I think that's therein lies the factual support for the trial court's finding here.
Except on redirect, he wasn't rehabilitated. All he suggested was that he did not intend to block him, which is not relevant under the case law. So it stands that he had more or less acknowledged that he was blocking the driveway and that the appellant would not have been able to get out.
Yes, and let's talk about that because I think you're getting to the key point. As Judge Johnson noted, the key point is not whether or not he encroached on the driveway. It's whether or not a reasonable person in appellant's position would have felt that they were seized and not free to leave. So the fact that he had been somewhere in the midst of that, you know, presumably two-car driveway, if he had encroached with his nose of his vehicle or his vehicle in that space, that in and of itself is not enough because the standard isn't where he parked. It isn't about how far he was from the curb or which side of the street he was on. No, the standard is how it affected the person in that car. He had no idea there was anyone in the car. He was shining his light where he was going to be walking to do a community service, you know, job of saying, you left your lights on. So he walks up the side of the driveway and sees the urine puddle first with two footprints looking out towards the lake. And again, important to remember, this is Lake Avenue. If a squad car is down 30 yards, according to the defense, it's 30 yards, a quarter of a football field away from a residential, the house here, and he is on the road. Lots of things happen by the lake. I grew up by on the River Road. Keg parties from teenagers, lovers lane, all kinds of activity that would never involve that officer signaling somehow to the homeowner, hey, it's 1 a.m. and I should be aware, you know, that I am being seized. No, too far away. Plus, we don't have any evidence that conclusively showing that he was actually blocked in. This guy never had any infringement upon his liberties where he could go. Let's look at that. A seizure occurs only when the officer, by means of physical force or show of authority, has in some way restrained the liberty of a citizen. Here, he did almost nothing. He put on his rear-facing aero light to alert other traffic on Lake Avenue not to hit his squad car. There's no evidence, you know, I realize what the defense said, but there was no evidence to indicate that there would be flashing lights appearing in this guy's thing. The only thing that might have been was the squad car spotlight, which apparently wasn't enough to see in the vehicle because he had to use his flashlight to do it. But before he's coming up to the door, he's up on the driveway, which is sloped above, you know, in the grade. And he sees the urine puddle with two footprints, which he found odd because it was facing the lake and which has come somewhat busy. And then he's walking up to the car. And then that's when he has the flashlight to see if there's keys in and he sees someone slumped over. What does the officer here do? He goes immediately into a welfare check. He's trained as an EMT.
Well, let's stop there for a minute. Counsel, yeah. You seem to be impressed by his actions there. He didn't knock on the door. He didn't identify himself. Now, you're saying he went into Amelia in a welfare check. I think proper procedure would have been for him to knock on that door to see if that would awaken the driver and at least to identify himself as a police officer and rather than just jam open the door.
I agree, Your Honor. I agree. But here's the facts are sort of what the facts are. So I want to own to the record that we have. And that is that he is coming through he sees the urine puddle and the footprints that lead back to the door of the driver's door of this vehicle. And he shines the spotlights to look for the keys and he sees the guy slumped over. And he said he slumped over in a position that he was worried about having a good airway because he's slumped on into the center console. There is, the fan is running, the air conditioning is going, and he smells the odor of alcohol before he opens that door. And then he goes right into opening the door because he said, I could tell he was breathing, but I wanted to put him down to get his airway open so he could be breathing well. And he tells us that he was trained as an EMT and he went right into EMT mode. Would it have been better police procedure for him to knock? I agree. Yes. Would it have been better for him to say, you know, I'm with this police department? Absolutely. Court, I completely and totally agree. This is a younger officer, you know, more new on the job, 11 months, I believe. And so that would have been the best procedure. But here, still, it doesn't constitute a seizure. Even opening that door under Overig, it does not constitute a seizure. And that's because if any seizure were to be found, same as State v. Lopez, even if you're doing a seizure there and you say, oh, by that interaction, that constitutes a seizure, it doesn't unless, because it's okay if it's for the purpose of a welfare check. And here we know that was his intention. And
Ms. Hedman,
go ahead, sorry.
Is there evidence in the record about The officer said, testified that he smelled alcohol. Did he smell the alcohol through the sunroof, I believe? Did he smell the alcohol before or after he opened the door?
Yes, before. And let me get to the site for that.
Well, that's okay. We can find it. I just wanted to know.
I believe it is before.
I mean, I believe you argued in your brief that that gave him reasonable suspicion of a crime before he opened the door. Is that correct?
Yes, I believe so, Your Honor, because of the urine puddle and odd nature of having that out in the open.
Did you argue that in your responsive brief?
Yes, and that the fact of opening the, if you find a seizure there, then that's true. That would be the alternate argument. But I don't think there's a seizure there even to begin with. If we look under Overeid versus Commissioner, opening the door after midnight, there was a person in an empty ballroom parking lot in Overeid, and the officer pulled up alongside the car, and they said that that squad car had illuminated the area, turn on the lights for that they may have done that. But then they tapped on the window, and then she kind of rolls over the other way. And then the officer opens the unlocked door. And so there is more there interaction before the opening of the unlocked door. But even though when they unlocked the door, they said there was no seizure by unlocking the door. But even if the Court of Appeals said that even if you were to find a court were to have found a seizure at that point, it would have been okay because it was a welfare check. And that's exactly what we have here. But if you're on Lake Avenue,
officer obligated though to make some non-obtrusive attempts to arouse what he sees as a breathing, sleeping person before he engages in an unannounced, no-knock, nighttime entry into his vehicle?
Yeah, thank you, Your Honor. I think that one thing to be clear is he does indicate he's breathing, but I don't know that he knows about his welfare status at that point.
Correct.
He's noting that he is in an odd...
Which is why I'm asking you, isn't the officer obligated to make at least some non-obtrusive attempts to ascertain his welfare before he undertakes those efforts in the middle of the night?
Yes, I agree. Best practices are that he should have, knocked on the door before going in.
What does that mean? Best practices. Does that mean constitutional practices?
I think all practices. I think just police practices, absolutely. And I think that, yes, he should have made some attempt. But here, the fact that he didn't doesn't indicate a seizure. But even if you were to find a seizure at that point, we have enough here to support the seizure based upon, number one, a welfare check, which I think this is clearly a welfare check.
That's my question, counsel. I mean, does the Constitution require that there is some additional level of inquiry before he opens the door without announcing himself or making some unobtrusive effort to ascertain his welfare in the middle of the night before he opens the door?
I think that it is would have been best practices to do that. Yes, I agree that it.
I'm not interested in best practices. I'm interested in the constitutional requirement.
Yeah, I appreciate that, Your Honor, and I apologize if I'm talking over you. I think the key thing is to know is that this is a welfare check, and like Overeid, he's going in, or like the case with in Coles parking lot, State v. Lopez, he's going in for purposes of a welfare check of this person. And so when you are trying to get someone to unlock the door or unlocking the door, he was concerned immediately for that. Should he have knocked? Yes, I completely concede that point. He should have. But in this circumstances, he was acting for his benefit, for his welfare, to make sure that he was consciously breathing and able to be assessed for his welfare. And that's exactly what it is.
Counsel, are you aware of any similar factual case, authoritative case, where a no-knock, nighttime, unannounced entry for a welfare check was justified under these was constitutionally valid?
Well, I think we have mentioned that because of the... the Overeg, there was some slight interaction with a person before that. And then in Lopez, there was some pounding on the window. But I think that that let's say that you say that by opening that door, you have a seizure right there. Let's just go right to the point of it. It doesn't matter because he's already found the urine puddle and he's already smelled the odor of alcohol and he already has a guy with his lights on with a car running for more than an hour because he was there an hour before and there an hour since. And this person wasn't locked in. He's 5 feet from his door and he could have walked in the house anytime. And I think if you see a squad car 30 yards, according to what the defense says, 30 yards by the side of the lake, you're not going to assume that you are seized. You are a reasonable person in his position is not going to meet the EDGH test. He is not going to feel that he is not free to leave. He's going to walk the 5 feet and go into his house, which is what he should have done.
I have a question and time's almost up, sorry. The officer you pointed out as he approached did even not know there was somebody even in that car, correct?
True.
Okay. So what about the implied license to enter the curtilage at that point? What basis does he have to proceed on his hunch?
Yeah, so Your Honor, I think a hunch is really far-fetched here. This gentleman is going up to the door because he has the car lights on and he's worried the guy's gonna have a dead battery. It's no different than a food delivery service from DoorDash or an Amazon driver. They park in front of my area all the time and walk up.
So I'm clear, the emergency is a dead battery.
Well, he's concerned that it's going to be a dead battery for them in the middle of the in the next morning, right? So he is not doing an emergency. No, it is a community service thing to say, hey, you left your lights on, turn your lights off. He is going where everybody goes. The mailman goes, the DoorDash guy goes, the Amazon guy goes. That's a public space. It is
not at 1 a.m.
available
though, usually.
And open.
Not usually at 1 a.m.
I don't know that the time clock changes for the area, the specific area of that. I'm not aware of any case law that says different times affects the ability for the public to enter. And he is entering a space where every public person, paper delivery boy, anybody could enter. And they're there at 5 a.m. So I'm not sure what the difference is. But regardless,
right. Counsel,
he's where he lawfully can be. Oh,
counsel,
sorry.
Counsel, I see that your time is up. Is there anything else from the panel this morning? All right, thank you very much. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Go ahead, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honors. I want to address mainly three things in my rebuttal. First, the clearly erroneous factual determination. Second, I want to discuss two cases on blocking. And third, I want to discuss this welfare check. First, the record's clear. The vehicle was blocked. We've been through this time and time again. There was no contradictory. On direct examination, the officer admitted that his car could have been blocking. When I asked him specifically, followed up, he said, yes, I was blocking. I asked him in two different forms and he admitted that that car couldn't leave. The car was blocked. There's no dispute about that. The district court didn't have maybe the advantages of looking through what was actually said and maybe there was some confusion there, but this isn't a dispute about one witness saying one thing, one saying another. This isn't a credibility determination. The officer gave two consistent statements. He may have been blocking. And then when I clarified, he said, yeah, I was blocking. The car couldn't have left.
Mr. Kajama, how long was the driveway? And is that relevant to is it relevant to our analysis?
I believe it is not relevant, Your Honor. And I would like to go through two different cases to discuss that. There's an unpublished case that this court decided, State v. Scheffler.
Maybe before you do that, but what is the evidence about the length of the driveway? Okay.
The length of the
driveway. Your opposing counsel said 30 yards, which is 90 feet. That's a long, long distance. But do you agree with 30 yards?
The record is unclear. The officer testified 30 feet. Then I asked him if it was more like 30 yards. It might have been an error in how I estimate length. But I guess the record is unclear. It's either 30 feet to 30 yards. But that distance doesn't matter. Here's why. Because the only exit to that driveway was blocked. In the Scheffler case, this court had very, very similar circumstances. The officer parked his vehicle between the defendant's vehicle and the only exit to the pasture. This court said that blocking that exit alone was a seizure. In the United States v. Keir case, this is a Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals case. In that case, here's where we get into the distance, Your Honors. The deputy was driving by. He saw a car parked by a barn on a residential property. Same thing we have here, car parked by a garage in a residential property. The officer pulled into the driveway. That driveway was approximately 70 to 100 feet long. It was a long driveway. The officer, when he pulled into that driveway, that vehicle was approximately, in the record, said 40 to 50 feet from the patrol car. This is a length of distance, 40 to 50 feet. The Keir court, United States v. Keir, said, quote, the freedom to depart was restrained at the moment the deputy blocked that driveway. Here, Mr. LeClaire's ability to leave and his freedom was restrained at the moment that officer blocked his driveway.
But doesn't that depend on sort of an intermediate fact that he or a reasonable person in his position in the circumstances was able to perceive that he was blocked or to see the patrol car? I mean, for example, let's imagine a long curved driveway with trees. And so the squad car at the end of the driveway blocking the end of the driveway is not visible around the bend. I mean, in that situation, is it possible that the mere blocking of the driveway, even if the person, the homeowner, is unaware of it? I mean, would that be a seizure?
I believe it would be, Your Honor, because the Keir case says at the moment he blocked, and the Scheffler case said when you block the only exit, it's a seizure. Therefore, it would be irrelevant, but regardless, in this case, we don't have that. There was a clear view from the officer's vehicle to the appellant's vehicle.
If it was 30 yards and it was nighttime and your client was facing forward, I guess, you know, I assume when he was sleeping in the driver's seat, he was facing forward. His only way of perceiving a squad car blocking his driveway, I suppose, would be his rear view or side view mirrors. And
same way that we all do, Your Honor, whether the cop car is parked behind us on a residential street or not, the only way to perceive the vehicle behind us is through our mirrors. It was clear that the spotlight was shining on the vehicle, therefore he could see.
The shining spotlight would probably hinder further his ability to see what was, you know, to see the end of the driveway. I don't know, but I don't remember any findings of fact about these particulars, so I don't want to stray too far from either the record or the district court's findings. But I'm just trying to. My question, I guess, my original question has to do with whether the length of the driveway is relevant.
And I believe it is not. And even so, the Keir case, there was a longer driveway. He was 40 to 50 feet away from the officer. And at that point, 40 to 50 feet, the Keir court said that was enough for a seizure. Therefore, the length of this driveway would be the same.
All right. Thank you, counsel. Is there anything else from the panel? I see that your time is up. All right. Counsel, this matter was well briefed and argued. Thank you so much for your cooperation and your accommodation through this virtual world. We'll take the matter under advisement and issue a written opinion within 90 days. All right, stay safe. Thank you.